today. As Trump continues to sow division in response to protests across the US, we ask what these past 11 days mean for America. The day after George Floyd was killed, they began.
George Floyd!
Protests.
George Floyd!
First in Minneapolis, where he died, and then as the days went on, across America. Kenya Evelyn, a Guardian US reporter, has covered protests like this before.
Police are working to clean up after a night of protests in Ferguson, Missouri. That's after prosecutors announced a grand jury decided not to charge Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown.
But the speed and urgency of these demonstrations have stood out to her.
You see a different energy. You definitely notice that there's a different sense of anger in just how quickly the protests spread nationally. And there's a different sense of this time enough is enough.
What doesn't surprise Kenya is why this is happening right now.
There are three major socio-political issues that are impacting African Americans disproportionately. We have a massive global pandemic, where right now African Americans only make up 14% of the US population and make about a third of all COVID-19 deaths. That's because of long-standing healthcare inequities and many racial inequities in our institutions here in the US. And what that is translating into is an economic downturn that is disproportionately also impacting African Americans. In fact, one in six African Americans lost their job on account of this pandemic. And so when you compound that with your everyday racism, that can eat away at you over time. And if you create the right spark, you're going to have a community that just has had enough. That is exactly what not just African Americans, but oppressed people, disenfranchised people, people who've been at the bottom, people who feel forgotten have just said, you know what? This is enough. I'm ready to fight.
From The Guardian, I'm Rachel Humphreys. Today in Focus, looking back on the protests that have shaken America. Kenya, in the immediate days after George Floyd's death, violence broke out in Minnesota and spread across the country. Where did people take to the streets across America?
I think it's important that we not lose focus on the fact that this originated in the Midwest. This is a very specific region of the United States that has a very unique history in which the Great Migration of the early 50s, 60s, and 70s saw a lot of African Americans leave the South to move to places like Chicago, Minneapolis, Detroit, my own hometown, Milwaukee, escaping what they thought was racism and violence. And for a lot of folks like myself, where it was maybe your parents or grandparents or even great-grandparents who made that journey, you almost feel a sense of betrayal that the very things that they are escaping are what you're confronted with on a daily basis in these Midwestern cities that experience their own economic and industrial declines, experience a white flight of white populations to the suburbs, and increase racial animus on account of that.
A new report lists Minnesota among the worst states in America for racial inequality. The website 24/7 Wall Street listed Minnesota as the second most unequal state in the country behind Wisconsin.
Black people in Minneapolis specifically are 13 times more likely to be killed by police than their white counterparts. So knowing that, we see similar patterns happening throughout the Midwest where Black communities in Midwestern cities are speaking out against increasing discrimination and racial animus that people like to pretend just does not exist in the North. And so that is why we are seeing protests erupt primarily in Minneapolis and Ferguson and Chicago. And then very quickly, it just resonated with so many hyperlocal issues regionally, nationally, and even now as we're seeing internationally.
Breaking now at 11, one nation united in anger.
Thousands of protesters gathered in Paris to express their outrage.
The biggest gathering London has seen in weeks and one of the most passionate.
Did that strike you, Kenya? You know, how quickly this protest movement spread and how far it went?
Yes and no. I think it just speaks to the power of social media, the power of viral videos. Of course, there are those who ask at what cost, because there is increasing evidence that exposure to these viral videos, particularly for African Americans, can produce even PTSD-like effects to mental health. But the spread of these viral videos essentially made this an issue that you could not turn away from. It made it a reality for people who would like to pretend that because they don't experience racism, racism just doesn't exist. Black Americans have been struggling and gasping for air and screaming for someone to let them breathe for much of their existence in this country. And now what we're seeing is simply the viral videos make our calls more noticeable.
There are millions of George Floyds.
Absolutely. There was Eric Garner. There is Trayvon Martin. There is Philando Castile. There is Seville Smith. There is Sandra Bland. We're not even considering oftentimes the number of Black women who are impacted by this. So we're seeing the same shouts for basic humanity and to allow people to breathe and live freely all across America in the streets.
Here to announce that former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin is in custody.
Last Friday, Derek Chauvin, the officer who knelt on George Floyd, was charged with third-degree murder. And then on Wednesday, this was upgraded to second degree. And the other three officers involved are now also facing charges of aiding and abetting. They appeared in court yesterday. How significant is all of this?
For many African Americans, justice does not end with charges. Justice ends with a conviction. And it's not just a matter of bad apple police, where bad apples essentially spoil the bunch. It's systemic. It's a matter of prosecutors. It's police unions. It's grand juries. It's this covert system that essentially dictates how far your humanity extends. And we see that even in medical examiners using pre-existing conditions to explain George Floyd's death.
The big story has been these autopsies. The Floyd family requested their own because they weren't satisfied with the county autopsy, which they didn't think was sufficient. Nor
those are the systemic issues in the judicial process that have made African Americans skeptical.
From your time out reporting on these protests, Kenny, and from what you've seen and reporting from across the state, who is protesting at the moment? Who's out on the streets? And is it a diverse group of people?
They're most times organized by local activists, local organizers, those who are deeply rooted in their communities.
Because in our neighborhoods, we already know from the young beginning, our parents had to tell us, sadly, that you got to be careful. Don't draw attention to yourself. Don't seem suspicious.
We're seeing people who are getting together to educate, to help register people to vote. And Black women are many times at the forefront of this. We see Black women taking the lead in calling out those who are also at these protests, who at times come solely with the purpose of agitating, and those are outside influencers.
And you think it's okay to take down a neighborhood? You don't see corporations here. There are human beings that live in this neighborhood.
And I don't mean out of state. I mean, they're not involved in a lot of these grassroots organizations. They're not organizers. They're not activists. They're coming solely because they may be frustrated with the economy. They may not be working. They may have lost their job. They have had to pay rent on Monday and couldn't. So there are other people who are, of course, using this opportunity to speak out about an injustice as a means to vent their frustrations about other issues.
Across the country, what started as peaceful gatherings protesting the death of George Floyd devolved into destruction.
What role have white supremacists played in these demonstrations, do you think?
I mean, totally, they're there to be agitators. They're there to be, to disrupt. They're there to instigate and to escalate tensions between police. And these groups are actually planning deliberate attempts to infiltrate protest movements or protest groups, or to show up at these events and escalate tensions by solely being destructive and damaging property while covered in all black, while, you know, spray painting back Black Lives Matter.
Y'all doing that for us and we ain't asking you to do that. Listen, don't spray stuff on here when they gonna blame black people for this and black people didn't do it.
There have been lots of images of violence on the news covering these protests, but have they been largely peaceful?
We have a saying here in the US to somewhat criticize our news media that if it bleeds, it leads. So it's much easier and it's much more fruitful to show the violence, to show destruction.
It was the most scared I have been since being chased out of Tahrir Square by a group from the Muslim Brotherhood.
But yes, there are protests, especially as we see them pass designated curfews of various cities, where they become increasingly hostile or increasingly violent. But it is fair to point out, as many both lawmakers and activists on the ground have pointed out, that sometimes they are totally unprovoked, that the aggression is coming at the hands of law enforcement.
He says this is what started it all, that police officer hitting that woman who was on the ground, the back of her head. Now, we did see police push that officer towards the other side of the garage, and that is when the protesters lost it.
And videos of protesters being subjected to violence at the hands of law enforcement have been shared widely online. But what has been the general police response to these protests across the country?
It's interesting. I would say disjointed. There isn't a singular unified police union, and there's even diversity within police ranks. You know, where are you if you are a Black officer? You were Black before you were ever blue. And so this creates a cognitive dissonance for many officers of color.
Please stay safe, do it the right way, and understand that there are police officers on this side that do agree with you and respect what you're
doing. Amen, bro.
Who recognize the disparities, recognize the unequal treatment within their own communities, but then also have a duty to protect and serve and believe in the mission of law enforcement. But we're seeing across the country, officers join protesters in march. We're seeing them take knees.
These cops love you. That cop over there hugs people, so.
So people are taking this as an opportunity to, what some will say, finally listen to the longstanding issues and cries of communities for quite some time. But then there's an obvious question of the sincerity and whether these are disingenuous, superficial attempts at showing unity without acting in that unity through policy and through the application of law in these communities. So it's just a matter of holding these police units accountable to that symbolic gesture of unity now.
One aspect of police response to these protests, which does feel different, is the very frequent attacks on journalists trying to report on this story.
I'm here.
Are you okay?
I'm getting shot. I'm getting.
Katie, are you okay?
Oh, press here, okay? We have permission to be out here. Stop it.
I mean, especially Black reporters like Omar Jimenez. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry?
You're under arrest.
Okay. Do you mind telling me why I'm under arrest, sir?
Lots of people have watched that clip of him being arrested live on television last week. What have you as a journalist made of this?
It's pervasive. This has been the case for journalists, particularly journalists of color, who, as we saw in earlier years, whether it be in 2014 with Mike Brown, this was primarily journalists of color who were going into these protests, who were experiencing, you know, volatility from police officers, from even fellow protesters. So violence against media has been the case in a lot of these movements. What's making it more prevalent, what's making it more a part of our public consciousness is that journalists are reporting it, more journalists are covering it. There are now more journalists there to be one of those victims. You know, I can't particularly say that in years past, reporting on race or racial justice or even social uprising was an immediate thought to a lot of organizations to send a reporter out. But yes, it's absolutely still fair to say that we're seeing with this particular administration, it taking a very combative approach to journalism and journalists. When you project that rhetoric onto a society, it begins to permeate in how people are treating those who are solely keeping this country informed. And so journalists are reporting the hostility, not just from law enforcement agencies, but from counter protesters. There's more of a sense of journalists being the agitators, those who are complicit in perpetuating a narrative that has permeated the American consciousness for so long, that Black people are the problem. There are people who still feel, activists and organizers, who feel like the media has been just as complicit in perpetuating this narrative that has allowed Black Americans to be treated differently and inequities to exist for so long.
Today, I have strongly recommended to every governor to deploy the National Guard in sufficient numbers that we dominate the streets.
It's not just the police that have been responding to these protests, Kenya. The National Guard, which is a reserve of the army that operates on a local level, has been deployed in more than 20 states. What's the significance of this?
The National Guard isn't new. My grandmother was born in 1922, and she will be 98 this year, God willing, on August 4th. She moved from Arkansas, the South, after the Klan intimidated her family into stealing and taking their land. And she thought taking my mother and her younger brother up to Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that great migration up to the Midwest, that they were escaping the violence and racism. They moved to Milwaukee in 1967 when my mother was 6 years old. And she can still recall definitively to this day, one of her first memories being in Milwaukee is of National Guard soldiers and tanks barreling through her neighborhood with guns drawn because Milwaukee was in the middle of its own race riot. So this is generational. It's happened in her lifetime. It is in my mother's lifetime. And now I'm experiencing it nearly 100 years after my grandmother's birth. So no, is the National Guard unprecedented? Absolutely not. Is it serving its purpose in perpetuating a idea of chaos? That depends on who you're talking to out in the streets.
But for so many people, it will be, as it is for you, symbolic of those generations of oppression in America.
Even growing up in Milwaukee, you knew where you could and could not go as a person of color. You knew what border you could not cross. You knew what speed you could not drive. That is a generational passing down of your feeling of being less than, of not quite being a part of the fabric of America, despite how much your people are responsible for sowing it.
After this, the divisive role Donald Trump has played in this week's protests. Kenya, Donald Trump has been heavily criticised for his aggressive response to these protests. Last week, as they gathered pace, he quoted a segregationist Southern police chief by tweeting, "When the looting starts, the shooting starts." And then on Saturday night, as protests reached the White House, he sheltered in a bunker, although he since said he was just inspecting it.
I was there for a tiny, little short period of time, and it was much more for an inspection.
He then tweeted to say that if protesters had got any closer, they would have been greeted with the most vicious dogs and the most ominous weapons. And then in the past few days, he's threatened to bypass state senators and deploy the army, a move which has been condemned by his own defense secretary.
The option to use active duty forces in a law enforcement role should only be used as a matter of last resort, and only in the most urgent and dire of situations. We are not in one of those situations now.
Why has the president responded like this?
I think there's a general consensus that the president has made it quite clear where his loyalty and where his priorities lie, his base, and the many organizational entities and PACs that support this ideology of an aggrieved America of mostly white Americans who feel left out of this globalized, increasingly changing world and increasingly changing society of America that no longer caters to them or looks like them. And that works for him. You know, it wasn't even a matter of a month ago when a mostly white militia stormed a Michigan Capitol armed with guns, armed even some with rocket launchers, and they were able to aggressively storm a Capitol, yell in the face of police, threaten police, barricade the governor in her office, and they were considered very fine people. They are considered patriots. The president of the United States is encouraging them by tweeting, "Liberate Michigan," but let a protester raise their hand up and say, "Don't shoot. I can't breathe." Somehow that is an affront to law and order, and protests are cracked down in that manner.
as you've mentioned, Trump has repeatedly played to his base in his response to these protests. And we saw that on Sunday when he tweeted that the United States of America will be designating Antifa as a terrorist organization.
The violence and vandalism is being led by Antifa and other radical left-wing groups who are terrorizing the innocent, destroying jobs, hurting businesses, and burning down buildings.
Who is he referring to in that tweet?
That's a really good question, because who is Antifa? All that means is the shorthand of anti-fascist. So is every single anti-fascist going to be labeled a domestic terrorist? Like, what is this phantom organization known as Antifa? There isn't one. This phantom Antifa, it creates a counter villain to the right. It creates a scapegoat for the right to beat up on as a way of saying, well, your people are the problem too. So I think it's an effort to show action without them being much substance behind it. And knowing that there hasn't been an equal application of the same labeling of domestic terror for white supremacist groups and far right groups, I think it was just, you know, many of those dog whistles and attempts at signaling, virtue signaling to his base that we've seen.
Kenya, what has it been like to live through this week in America?
Exhausting. I'm exhausted. As a journalist, you're exhausted because, geez, you have a pandemic, you have an even complete economic decline, and then you have yet again, something that becomes a routine cycle almost every 2 years in the summer of Black people being unequally treated at the hands of police officers and then losing their lives on account of it. You just need a second to breathe, but then you realize, you know, George Floyd didn't have that second to breathe. So you have an obligation out there to continue this reporting. But then on a personal level, when these issues impact you, when these issues are impacting communities who look like you, who have even more of an obligation to reflect the pulse of the moment and of the people in a way that's authentic. So I've seen countless stories, countless pieces in the last week from many Black journalists who are echoing that same thing. They're exhausted, but they're not exhausted simply because of the workload or the reporting load or even the gravity of the situation. They're exhausted because it's a sense of, finally, this is what we've been shouting. This is what we've been covering. This is what we've been reporting. This is what we've been saying, not only from our content, but from our lived experiences. Why haven't you been listening?
Earlier this week, former President Barack Obama spoke about how he hopes these protests can translate into policy change. And he also addressed young Black people directly in his message.
Now, I want to speak directly to the young men and women of color in this country who have witnessed too much violence and too much death. And too often, some of that violence has come from folks who were supposed to be serving and protecting you. I want you to know that you matter. I want you to know that your lives matter, that your dreams matter. And there is a change in mindset that's taking place.
But do you think that new voices and new leaders will emerge from this period of protest for younger generations?
Absolutely. And I think there has been for quite some time a generational disconnect among Black communities in the sense that the old guard, the pillars of a civil rights era and the leaders who are always there to speak out haven't always been those who want to pass the baton. And so there's an entire generation of Gen Xers, of millennials who have been disserviced by essentially a gatekeeping of that leadership. And so now, when there should be maybe a unified voice or singular group that can speak to the pain of people and this particular era and this particular generation, there's a grasping of that from various entities because there isn't a succinct uniformity in who we look to speak for us. But then at the same time, there's people who say, you know, the plight for Black liberation and equality in this country has been underserved by the idea that a singular image or a singular person stands to unite it. Movements like these, movements that start at the grassroots, movements that start with organizers in the communities connected to them, is more organic and more impactful than parachuting your civil rights leader to give a speech.
Finally, Kenya, coronavirus has created a new public health crisis in America, an economic crisis, and now we've seen a week of countrywide protests after yet another brutal killing of a Black man in police custody. How does America recover from all of this?
How can it? I think that is a question we ask every time until the next hashtag pops up on our timelines. That is something that requires introspection of a country. There is, you know, the whole idea of if you don't know your history, you're bound to repeat it. And there are opportunities to learn so that the next time there is a hashtag, we're saying this is the plan of action, holding these leaders, holding this police officer, holding this law enforcement agency accountable. But until we have a recognition that there's even a need to at the system-wide level, then, you know, it's almost like just you hold your breath. You hold your breath until the next hashtag, until the next person who's saying, I can't breathe.
Kenya, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read more of Kenya's reporting at theguardian.com and also keep up with the latest as the protests continue via our US live blog. Also on Tuesday at 6 p.m, The Guardian is hosting an online event where our journalists will be discussing the latest developments on this story, and you'll be able to put your questions to them too. Find out more at theguardian.com/Guardian Live. Thank you for listening today, and also for all your reviews and feedback on the podcast this week. Today's episode was produced by Courtney Youssef, and the sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. Have a great weekend. We'll be back on Monday.